Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hi, this is Henry Gilroy, co-executive producer of Star Wars Rebels. You're listening to Aggressive Negotiations.
Welcome, everybody, to Aggressive Negotiations. I'm just one of the hosts here, Matthew Rushing, and we're coming up you from, the salt flats of Crete. It's just fantastic out here. I mean, getting some fantastic rays, I gotta say. And with me, as he is always, the ever-toned, ever-tan, John Mills.
Yes, thank you. You're catching the rays on Crete, you said?
Yeah, did you get that?
How are you spelling those?
Isn't that great? Oh, man, just such good stuff.
It's the best thing to come out of Crete in a while. Yeah.
Well, I got to say, it's great to be here, John, and we are going to be talking all things Last Jedi extras, the things that we learned from the extras. This home release is now out for digital and like Blu-ray, 4K, DVD, yada, yada. I mean, I said they don't do Betamax anymore, but it's all out now. And we've gotten a chance to take a look at it all, and we're going to be talking about it. But before we do that, just a quick reminder, man, you could find the Nerd Party all over the place. Nerd Party is on Twitter, @JoinNerdParty. We also have the show account for Aggressive Negotiations, @TheJediMasters. Now, follow both of those places, because we have great information coming in to you from the network. And if you love all things Star Wars, then you should be following us here at The Jedi Masters, because that's all we do is Star Wars goodness all the time on that Twitter feed. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TheNerdParty. We've got the website at thenerdparty.com. While you're over on iTunes or Apple Podcasts looking us up, and make sure you subscribe and give us a star rating review. You probably hear this all the time from every single podcast, but it really does help the show. It helps more people find us. There are a lot of Star Wars podcasts out there, and if you like what we do here, let people know that by giving us that star rating review and letting people know why you think they should be listening. And of course, if you would like to send us an email, go over to thenerdparty.com/contact, choose a show, choose Aggressive Negotiations, and then I'll come to John and I, and we'll be able to talk to you that way. So, John, the extras were just loaded, and I wanted to start actually here, which is with the deleted scenes, because this is one of the few Star Wars movies that we really have gotten, I would say, a plethora of deleted scenes. And so, I was surprised how many there were, but Rian Johnson came on beforehand and said, there was a lot of stuff. The movie was very long. We had to cut out some of my favorite stuff, but we're leaving it here for you. So, I figured we'd just walk through some of these. Some I'm sure that will probably be like, it doesn't really do anything, whatever. Yeah. And some of these we might have a more lengthy conversation on, but the very first deleted scene here is an alternate opening, and I'm interested to hear what you think about this, because it is quite a bit different, actually.
Yeah, I think it's quite a bit better, honestly. I do, because the thing is that the stamp that The Last Jedi has been trying to stand itself up on is that it's been a reversal of expectations, and I think that the way that this alternate opening goes is the type of different that would have been more intriguing to me than what they went with. And I think it also would have allowed people, even if you still have the Poe prank call bit, it's at least eased into. It's there, you're given distance to reacclimate yourself, and it's not a splash of cold water saying, what's, huh? I just think it's a smoother opening, personally. I'm still not nuts about the fact that the transitional cue from the crawl-up fanfare is literally recycled from episode 4, but hey, if wishes were fishes. What type of reaction did you have?
So I've read the novelization. I know you haven't got a chance to get to it with your busy schedule with a family and all, and so there is a great scene in that, which is the funeral for Han, and that's how the main story opens. And I really actually liked that, because I felt like what it did is it allowed you to ease into this movie, but it also it helped with the flow of the film, in the sense that because we're going to be jumping back and forth between Octu and this Resistance story, by having the film start off slower, you get the feeling like more time has passed.
Yes.
Because obviously Rey's journey has to take time. Because we actually go back in time a little bit, in the sense that, you know, we see her the moment she's handing the lightsaber to Luke. And so I feel like this opening does that same thing. It gives more breathing room, and you get the feeling like, you know, they got back to the Resistance. You know, they knew that this was going to be coming. That's why they've been preparing for this. Poe even makes that suggestion of saying, well, we knew this was coming, and that they were going to find us. And I just think it gives it's not that it slows down everything, but it's just that I think it brings us into where we are for the film in a way that contextualizes things better.
Yes.
And it allows you to kind of like, I think, kind of breathe into it more. And so I was interested in the fact that this alternate opening got cut, because I'm surprised that it did. It seems like more of a surprise to start with Finn waking up. You know,
yeah.
Like if subverting expectations, you know, I think that is actually the expectation. That's really an expectation subverter. So,
right.
Yeah, to me, this was just, yeah, so.
Yeah, it doesn't open with a ship. I think it's a more interesting visual. Yeah, I mean, yes, there's a ship, but you know what I'm saying? Like, I think it's a more interesting visual change.
And it's really unique too.
Yeah. And I know we'll get to talking about the documentary, but you actually hear him talking about changing the opening in the documentary. And I think it's a case of somebody second guessing themselves, and I wish somebody had been there and said, "Nah, you can let this one stand. It's cool." You
well,
know?
And I'll reference the documentary a little bit here too, because watching it, you can see that Johnson second guesses himself a lot.
Yeah.
He seems to be very wishy-washy, in the sense of being firmly planted that he's doing the right thing in a lot of places, and especially some of the biggest decisions that he makes about Luke, about something like the opening and things like this. He doesn't have a set idea of what he wants to do. And it's not that JJ thing where he's on set and he's like, oh, this is gonna be awesome if we do this, you know, like, it's not that frenetic energy of like, you got this new idea that just came to you as you're seeing the setup. It's more of that kind of like frantic scaredness of like, am I doing the right thing with this story here? And he doesn't seem to necessarily feel always that he is completely doing exactly what he thinks he should be doing.
Well, and here's where I'm going to draw a difference. And again, you know, like I do honestly think that the discussion about The Last Jedi can get so charged sometimes.
Oh yeah.
That it's kind of crazy, but I do honestly think that there's a difference between what Lucas did, which was he knew he was going to have to go and shoot pickups, and he's also notorious for shooting a lot of stuff on set. And then, you know, I'm going to make it
right
in the editing room.
Right.
And I think that I would have been less surprised if we saw him in the editing room and he sees a cut of the film and he says, this isn't working, we got to fix it, which is the sort of approach that I think is typical of a Lucas or other directors out there, as opposed to I'm still on set shooting things and I've been thinking about it and I'm not so sure about it. It's like you got to let it breathe. And if you're going to make a change like that, I mean, you know, but every director is different. Maybe this is how he works on every film. Maybe this is just what he does. And so I'm not going to peg it with like a negative. I'm just going to say that it was surprising to me, because I'm more used to the mindset of, well, let's see how it works and then we'll decide whether to fix it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. No, I agree. So the next deleted scene was Paige's guns jam during the battle there. And, you know, I think this is definitely a scene that doesn't necessarily yeah. need to be there. I think it's one of those things where you shot it and you know, it, you get it into the editing room and it's just not necessary.
Yeah, it's an extra beat that just adds time. It doesn't right. add anything to the character, really.
Well, and, you know, the only thing it does is connects you again with the medal that she has, that Rose has, and it connects them with as sisters. And that's not a bad idea. I just think in that scene, it's just when you're cutting it all together, that's definitely one I think, you know, you can let go and you don't feel like you are losing anything in the long run. So, whereas the next one, Luke has a moment, I am speechless as to why this is not in the film.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's so brief, and I think that, and the thing is, I don't view it as, because I had this conversation with Mike Schindler, you know, on Great Shot Kid recently. I don't think that it's something where now it's being cast where, you know, in my discussion with him, he was like, oh, well, I like the green milk better and you don't need this scene because it's still, you can have both because this is so.
Yeah, absolutely.
And for anybody who doesn't know, Mark Hamill made a comment where he said, I don't understand why you could show me, you know, milking the cow, but you couldn't show me having a tear for Han. And I think that it would have ease the audience into Luke's journey and Luke's place in the story more to see him instantly, very early on, express pain and regret about what's happening.
Well, and this is something that references the Balance of the Force documentary, this yeah. 10-minute documentary they did, where he talks about the idea of why Luke is there. And Luke believes he's there because he is learning the lesson he thinks that he didn't learn in Empire. And so okay. that idea plays into this, that he would feel these feelings then, right? You know, like he would. Yeah. So it's like that never really plays out in the movie whatsoever. It's kind of retroactively, I feel like Johnson saying that's what I was going for, but I don't feel like I get that necessarily in the film strong enough, especially if you're not a super geek fan like us. So that would have at least been one of those moments that kind of helped with that.
This is the reason I'm chomping at the bit here. I know we're trying to go through the deleted scenes, but since we brought up Balance of the Force and, you know, the fact that, you know, the Luke's journey and everything, I have to divert to it at this point because you specifically bring up something that just went off like a firecracker for me while I was watching the Balance of the Force, little featurette mini documentary thing. My sense, and we've talked about this with The Force Awakens and also with the, you know, not believing Kylo can be redeemed and everything, we had a whole episode where we talked about what's the value of redemption in the Star Wars storyline now. And both The Force Awakens and now The Last Jedi, and The Last Jedi explicitly through Johnson's own words, both make reference back to The Empire Strikes Back in such a way that it vaults past anything that happened in terms of character growth for Luke in Return of the Jedi. I think that it was very illuminating to me to watch that featurette because I say, oh yeah, well, if you consider The Empire Strikes Back your jumping off point, okay, I see what you're talking about here. But Luke demonstrates having learned that lesson and having figured things out in Return of the Jedi. You have to make a conscious decision to jump away from Return of the Jedi to have this work. And it just supports that idea of why it was like the question we've all had since The Force Awakens. Why didn't Kylo assign any weight to that revelation that he has in Return of the Jedi? Well, apparently because the filmmakers are blowing past it too. And if that works for people, okay, it very decidedly doesn't work for me. And I think that just put the finger right on it at the source of some of my issues.
Well, and You know, I think as we walk through these deleted scenes, we'll get this opportunity, but honestly, to keep talking about some other things, but to continue on with that thread for just a second, I think that it's the thing that for me doesn't work as well, because what he also says about Luke's feelings about the Jedi seem very incongruous as well, that they have been nothing but problems for the galaxy, and that they need to die. Like, the light needs to rise from another source. And yet, I still can't understand that rationale when I look back at the canon of Star Wars, and from what we know, and I was just rewatching the Zygerian arc in the Clone Wars, and one of the Zygerian slavers is incensed and just angry at the Jedi when he's beating the crap out of Obi-Wan Kenobi, because the Jedi are the ones who destroyed their slaver empire 1,000 years ago. And so it's like the Jedi have had an amazing impact on the galaxy.
Well,
and so to say that they only brought problems to the galaxy in the span of, when we're talking thousands of years here, right, is just ridiculous. And it, and again, I come down to the fact that it all comes down to the idea that I feel like Luke has that feeling because he screwed up thinking he was kind of following these Jedi tendencies and assigning, well, then now the Jedi just need to end. And again, it seems to me to become a sign of arrogance and not necessarily have anything really to do with whether the Jedi should end or not.
Yeah, I mean, I know that we're getting dangerously into that territory, so of re-prosecuting arguments that we've had. But you know, to be clear, I don't necessarily take issue with sort of exploring that, because the end of Return of the Jedi is Luke. My issue with it is, again, vaulting past Return of the Jedi ignores the fact that by the end of that, Luke does symbolize that new way, that new light that rises. So if they had simply had a moment where Luke says, the problem is I tried to do it the way it had been done before, and I was the one that figured out the new path forward, you know, but that's a whole thing.
Right. Absolutely. And I think that the other thing that for me has really crystallized is that the reason that Johnson has for him to be on the island, and he talked about this idea in the documentary and in the Balance of the Force, like, why is he there? For him, Luke Skywalker's not a coward, right? Why would he be there? And it's because, obviously, he thinks he needs to do this lesson of Empire Strikes Back. Basically, I need to stay here because, you know, I'm going to cause more problems than I solve. And on top of that, negating what we get in Return of the Jedi, I think that also negates the way in which Luke himself set up in The Force Awakens, just a film before. He left a map for himself to be found.
Right. Yes.
He all of a sudden doesn't want to be found. And so, like, even with its previous, just the very film right before this, this doesn't really feel like it fits. And this moment that they cut out, I feel like, was just a great moment for Luke to kind of bring it all back around, where he feels the weight of not being out there.
Well, let's tie this back in, because you and I have talked, you know, offline, you know, on the other side of the negotiations, however we want to say it, about that map, because Laura Santeca has a map to Luke, and you don't leave a map if you don't want to be found, and unless you say, well, I'm removing myself until somebody figures out how to come and get me, then I'll know it's time, blah, 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 blah. But let's tie that back into the deleted scenes. I know we're jumping ahead a little bit. So let's just say we'll inevitably wind up coming back to this with one of the deleted scenes. What's the next in our list of deleted scenes?
Yeah, the next one is Poe, not much of a sower. And this is another scene that's very small, but I felt like it's a moment that helps Finn's character and help him explain to the audience why he's going to do what he's going to do in just a moment when he tries to leave. Because for him, this is still all about protecting his friend Rey, the only person that he's really truly connected with in this way. And I think this scene is like 30-40 seconds in it, and I don't know why it's not there, because again, it's just context.
Right. You could have cut some of the farrier racing just for the sake of having. No, you could. You could trim.
No, I agree with you. I mean, let's just talk about it for a second. I mean, because we can just get it out of the way right now. It's already a deleted scene in here because it was even longer than it was. It's like it makes you long for the days of pod racing, because at least that had a story point for Anakin. This is just needless, like, racing through a city because, hey, it looks kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, Star Wars, there are plenty of sequences where, hey, it just looks kind of cool. I mean, I'll go back. One of the criticisms I have for Attack of the Clones is that that speeder chase on Coruscant takes a little long.
Yeah,
and I thought there was stuff they could have included, on Naboo with the Naberi family, instead of having, you could have cut that in half, and it would have been. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So just so people know that it's not like I ignore the flaws of length in other ways. But yes, I mean, the pod race, as much as people have complained about the length of that, at least demonstrates how special a kid Anakin is, that he can do that thing. This is, it's horse racing, I guess. But yeah, I actually saved this for the last one because I just dreaded going back to it, because I was just like, I can't do this. All that to say, they made the right choice to go with a shorter version.
What do you think of, there's another small scene with Finn and BB-8. It's kind of weird that you recorded that.
You know, what's funny is I've complained about the Marvel humor that is in The Last Jedi that makes it feel like a Marvel movie, but this actually feels more like the Finn humor we got in The Force Awakens. So yeah. I didn't mind this joke. And I mean, to speak to your point about supporting why Finn is so focused, it makes him look like less of a deserter and actually more of a hero to go after Rey and emphasize that.
Mm-hmm.
Is it necessary to include? I don't know, but I wouldn't have minded it.
Yeah, again, I don't need to talk a long time on this. I just think it is a fun one in the sense that, and I think it's just a good character moment for Finn. Again, it helps explain his character and why he's doing what he does. And again, I feel like watching a lot of these scenes, the editing of the film bothers me because it's cutting one of my biggest problems with the entire sequel trilogy, but especially this one, is context, context is so important in storytelling, especially with character moments. And I'm just surprised that some of these didn't make it, because the next scene is the caretaker sizes up Rey, and this is not necessary, but I love the whimsy of it with the caretakers. And I feel like I would have loved more of this than maybe necessarily Luke milking space cows, just because it's a fun little interaction between Luke and Rey and this caretaker and all that. And I thought it was great. And again, it's a minute scene, So
I can take it or leave it. But to come back to the space cow scene, I'm actually, I actually really like that, because Luke's whole thing in that is, we learn about his living off the land, but also he's taking joy because it somehow revolts Rey.
Yeah.
Which in and of itself is surprising, because Rey is somebody who 2 days previously was living in abject poverty with food that had to be, generated from drops of water. I think she'd if anything, Rey would be like, oh my gosh, you have an endless supply of milk? That's amazing.
Well, yeah, and I think, for her just being around that much water too, it is an interesting thing to think for her life, how crazy it's gotten. The next one is probably the biggest scene that gets cut from the film, I would say, and that is the third lesson.
Yep.
And I would say, unequivocally, like Luke has a moment, this is another scene that should absolutely 100% be in the film.
Yes.
Because it is, again, I think, pivotal for context. And it's the context of the battle between what Rey believes and what Luke believes.
And Luke's realization at the end of the scene, very apparent in his performance, of, have I made a terrible, terrible mistake?
I've made a huge, terrible mistake, Michael.
I got to be honest with you. And I know how people loved seeing Yoda and everything. I honestly think if you have this scene, you don't even need that tree scene with Yoda. You have enough in this and Luke's reaction at the end of it that him coming back makes sense afterward.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and so in the book, in the novelization, this scene happens.
Mm-hmm.
Rey storms off and has her moment in the cave. And Luke goes and has his moment where he opens himself up to the Force for the first time mm-hmm. and feels Leia. And that, and on his way down to Rey's hut, his thought process is, she's right. I can't just stay here. I have to. And that's the moment when he catches her and, you know, Kylo playing Patty Fingers and gets all pissed and then decides he's not going to leave again. But there is that really strength. I think there's that strength of a narrative there, like you're saying, where it really does, you know, help that progression of Luke realizing, no, he's the one that's wrong, not Rey. Right. Yeah. Which I think, again, if you had been able to pull that story out like that, really hard to really show Luke coming around, I think I would have responded better to the story.
Yeah.
Even just the way it is, just with these scenes and kind of maybe using some other things to pull it out even farther, I think you could have done it and I could have come around to it, but they didn't, and it's frustrating. So
yep.
Mega Destroyer Incursion, the extended version with Tom Hardy's cameo. What did you think of this one?
I'm grateful they cut it, because if they had spent yes. longer on there, I would have been even more annoyed.
Yeah, me too. No, I felt exactly the same way. I liked the tension for them in the turbolift.
Until
it turns into a joke.
Yep.
So, yes, the tension was great. And if that actually had been the only thing that they had done, it just had that tension and had less of it a joke of like, hey, Finn, congratulations. You know, like that would have been interesting, because still it's uncomfortable.
Also think about it, it's also another thing that has kind of bothered me about the fact that, okay, I went along with it in Force Awakens of, oh, I was stationed on Starkiller Base. I know, you know, what's going on. Okay, cool. And then I was a bit annoyed that in this, oh, well, I was also stationed on the Mega Destroyer. So is there a really small janitorial corps in, you know, in the First Order? You just go everywhere, but okay, we'll work with that. And then to run across somebody in this gigantic organization in the elevator, they've done a lot just to make the First Order feel smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
So I'm
yeah.
glad that this was cut, because it didn't work to undercut the size of the First Order as a result.
Well, what did, I mean, I think I know what the answer is, but Finn biting the hand that taunts her.
Rose.
Rose biting. Sorry. Rose biting the hand that taunts her. I just, doesn't need to be there.
They made a good call.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
Now, what they didn't make a good call on, and I'm going to call this again unequivocally, should have been in the movie, is Phasma squealed like a Wupog, because dang, this scene is so good.
I wanted to scream in frustration when I saw the alternate version of Phasma's
like an
demise.
Angry Wookiee.
Yeah, I was floored. I was absolutely floored, because I would have been down with this. I think this would have been an amazing moment and given Finn a purpose,
yes.
You know, an arc. He finally stands up to the person that intimidated him in The Force Awakens, and not just, he doesn't have anybody backing him up. He's standing up to her. It makes his character better and stronger. And instead, she goes off screen in a way where they can bring her back in the next one.
Well, and this is the, I think it also makes the moment of him choosing, because when he says rebel scum,
yeah,
like he's choosing to identify himself with the people that they think are scum.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, I'm proud to be that. Like, that's the moment where he makes that decision. And I think it's so strong. I also think, just for us who read the comic and the book, it nicely ties all of that together with everything mm-hmm. that they told us about Phasma. And it makes her less of just like this weird accessory they keep throwing in that's kind of meaningless.
And she even gets a moment where she gets to be more of a bad badass. Because
bad mamma jamma.
Yeah, she gets to gun down the other troopers. She's a yep. super quick draw, and you're like, whoa, that's awesome. Like, you see this flash of how awesome she is, why she's wearing the chrome armor. And yeah, it baffles me why this was cut. It really does.
So the other scene that we got was Finn and Rey go where they belong. I mean, I think if you had had the Phasma scene in there, it's definitely not needed. And even when you don't have the Phasma scene that same way, I still think this one is, I mean, it's just a tiny little beat, but it's not needed.
Yeah, agree.
What I did kind of like was the Rey and Chewie and the Falcon, because it just brings them back into the film instead of it just being like, then they don't show up until like later. And so it just brings in that continuity a little bit. It's not necessarily needed, but I liked it for context.
Well, I have a lot of complicated feelings about the whole crate thing and the Falcon chase in that. So all that being said, yeah, I mean, it's another thing where it's so brief. Like, I can understand being on the fence and then cutting something that's like, you know, a 4-minute alternate version or a 4-minute scene, or we need to save time, so we're going to do this.
Yeah.
But it's these little 30-second things where nobody would have noticed it in terms of running time. So I don't know.
So I wanted to ask you, because we had talked about it, was there anything else for you that you got out of the Balance of the Force documentary? It's about 10 minutes, a little over 10 minutes long. Was there anything else that you pulled from that you thought was interesting?
I think that there's a misconception that when people have criticisms of The Last Jedi or certain things of it, it's because in some way they didn't understand it. But it didn't really blow my mind with any other thing other than having that, what I said, you know, what I called the firecracker moment, where I put the finger on it, where I was like, that's it. They just confirmed they're ignoring Return of the Jedi. If I ignore Return of the Jedi, The Last Jedi works better. And I was like, okay, I understand the thinking at least. So now I get it. What about you? Was there anything else you took from it?
Yeah, Ryan saying that he kind of wanted to do a reset on the Force for all the new kids coming in, and I kind of get what he's saying, and I honestly don't have a problem with, you know, the connection between Rey and Kylo. I don't have a problem with the Force power that Luke has of, you know, putting himself on crate even though he's not there.
No, I don't really have it.
Yeah, I don't have any problems with any of the things that he did there. I think the thing that what he talked about in there that I just had the most issue with was I really take umbrance with the fact that I don't understand how Luke can think what he's thinking unless, like you said, it's almost as though Return of the Jedi doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Because Luke already has learned this lesson and actually learned it very well. Because that's what Return of the Jedi is all about, is him overcoming that lesson actually in a way that, you know, Yoda and Obi-Wan did not expect. And so I think that's the thing that just kind of got me there. Otherwise, you know, the things that Ryan actually did with the Force in that way, I thought were pretty cool. And again, they kind of just like, you know, you expect Luke to pull out hopefully a Force power you've never seen before, because he is supposed to be like, you know, he's like the ultimate Jedi at this point, or at least we're supposed to, hoped he'd be. So, yeah, I didn't really have any issues
in
with
a
that
sense,
stuff.
In a sense as well, it's just an extension of what we saw with Rey and Kylo through the whole film. So I never had a problem with the whole projection thing. It just, I was like, oh, cool. In terms of a surprise moment, I think that it's less cool on repeat viewings, simply because once the O. Henry factor is gone, it's like, okay, I know he's not, I think it works against itself on repeat viewings. So it's an interesting sort of conundrum, but at the same time, I think it's a cool power. And again, just an extension of what we saw through the whole film.
Well, and what I do love about it too is that Luke, by doing that, doesn't allow Kylo to be responsible for his death.
Right.
You know, which I think is such an act of grace that he's showing Kylo. He's going to confront him and all of that, but he's not going to allow him to be the one that causes his death. Luke is the one that allows his spirit to kind of, you know, ascend into the Force.
Right.
And I think that's a really neat moment. And I think it's the right choice at that moment. I think that part of what Ryan did there is great. It's still a very neat scene. One of the things that was fascinating to me, because it has been a long time in Star Wars since we've had a documentary like this.
Yep.
The Director and the Jedi, it's over an hour and a half long. And I'm wondering what you thought of it. What did you pull out of this one? What was interesting to you about it? And did you enjoy getting to watch through this as much as maybe like, Empire of Dreams or The Beginning or the documentary they did for The Force Awakens?
I liked it better than any of the extras that I saw for Force Awakens. I thought that it was, in a large sense, refreshingly honest. But in other ways, there were moments that very much felt too manufactured, too guarded, too aware of the camera sort of stuff. I enjoy any documentary where I get to see the director in process or explain their thinking, or even the department heads who get to talk about the experience. That says a lot to me. And I can honestly say that seeing the director in The Jedi, I understand now why so many people, Kathleen Kennedy included, said it was such a joy working with him. He seems like a really great guy to work with. He seems like a really supportive guy, a really, willing to share credit, really collaborative. I think that he has all the qualities that you would want in somebody that you're working for, you know, that would be a lot of fun to work with. That said, any ding that I give is because there were moments that felt like I thought the ending took a little bit too long to resolve. It was one of those things where it was like, okay, let's move along. It was unfortunate that I don't know how I feel about how much Carrie Fisher was featured in it. I don't know if it was too little. I don't know if it was enough. I don't know. It's so weird because it just seems, it didn't seem as open as the other parts of the documentary, which I found interesting. But again, the title of it is The Director and the Jedi. So it seems like the focus should have been on Rian Johnson and, Mark Hamill, through the process. So, yeah, I mean, I thought it was thoroughly enjoyable. I was glad I watched it, and I have to give Disney and Lucasfilm one of the things we've complained loudest about with Force Awakens and Rogue One home releases is where the hell is my exhaustive documentary? And they came through, and they delivered it. So,
yeah,
kudos.
You know, I, looking back on what they did for the Rogue One release, you know, they had a very troubled past.
Yeah.
Even as the day we're recording, there was some news that came out about the behind the scenes stuff for Rogue One, and so you know, I think, you know, Disney loves to control the narrative. You know, I'm not afraid to say that they do.
Yes, they do.
And here it was easy because Ryan does make it easy for them, and I think that is the thing that one of the things I did come away with was that Ryan is a great guy, you know.
Yeah.
He just is. You know, he's a great guy, and I feel like he would be a joy to work with and a lot of fun. He is kind of like a huge kid in a candy store. I mean, even when he just walked into those production offices and they'd show him something and he'd just laugh, you know, sounded like a kid, you know, just laughing because he has so much joy of seeing what they're doing. And so but I for where you were able to pinpoint your issue, you know, with Balance of the Force, for me, the director and the Jedi, I was able to finally pin down what it was for me about The Last Jedi. And at the beginning, they're talking about him writing the story,
mm-hmm.
and the idea that, and I think even Kathy is a part of this conversation with Ryan, and they're kind of going, the editing is bringing all these people in, but they're talking about how, you know, obviously for George and the original trilogy and the prequels, it's personal,
mm-hmm.
And so he had to find out what was personal for him for this film. And as much as I appreciate that thought process, and I think that it's a halfway decent idea. I think that the problem is that for the episodic films, because they are all following a linear story of a family through successive generations, and because they have beforehand, all six of them have come from the same person's mind, and then the seventh did a good job of fitting in with that mold, you know, and Eight needed to be able to find Rian Johnson's personality as well as the George Lucas sensibilities of storytelling and structure and those kind of things to be able to continue the tone poem in a way that felt congruous with everything that came before.
You know what? I'm going to build on that because I do think you're onto something there, but I will also say that, yes, Lucas did tell personal things. We've all heard my theories about, you know, certain things that carried over from his personal life into, say, episode 3 and stuff like that. And you can see very much a personal story in the prequels of Lucas revisiting what everything meant to him. But the mission statement of Star Wars, if you go back to the original making of Star Wars from 1978 that came out, narrated by William Conrad. I have the thing practically memorized because in the era of videotape, I possessed that far longer than I possess any copy of the film. I can tell you that he sat there and he said one of his goals was to create a good, wholesome adventure. He was telling personal things, but he was telling them in the context also of larger ideas and stories, for lack of a better term, mythologies that he wanted to convey. So it wasn't just a personal story. It was also a bigger story with lessons he was trying to teach along the way. And I think that that speaks to maybe what longtime fans like us sometimes aren't connecting with the sequel trilogy is we're getting the sense of entertainment and we're maybe even getting the personal stuff coming across, but we're looking for that. I don't know how to describe it, but you get what I'm going for, right?
Yeah, and I think to continue on that thread, I'll bring us back to our conversation, you know, we had with Henry Gilroy and ourselves about the end of Rebels. And it's very clear what's personal for Dave Filoni in those stories.
Mm-hmm.
It's obvious. It's the wolves. I mean, there's so many things in there that are very personal for him. Ahsoka coming back, all of this stuff, right? And yet, none of it feels out of place or mm-hmm. incongruous with everything else that we've done before. And yet, some of it's new and exciting and different. Very different. I mean, I don't think we've ever seen space whales save the day before.
That is true.
So, you know, I think all of those things, it is a mixture of everything that Dave understands about Star Wars storytelling. What you were talking about, this mythological storytelling idea of values and understanding these things, putting all that together with his own personal, he learned how to be able to combine the Lucasian with the Filonian. And you put those two together, and he was able to create kind of a new flavor of Star Wars that still felt like the old. And I do think that that's one of the things that the sequel trilogy, and especially I think The Last Jedi, just was not able to do, because there was kind of a rejection in some places. I felt like, as you rightly pointed out, this Lucasian Star Wars, specifically in the sense of feeling like we're negating the work that had been done in Return of the Jedi.
Well, and I also think that The Last Jedi, I at no point would take anything away from Rian Johnson. Again, seems like a great guy, great collaborator, decent human being, all of that stuff. I think that his sensibilities were more suited to a standalone than an episode.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
And I think that's what the director in The Jedi teases out, is if he had done a movie about a Jedi on a similar sort of thing that wasn't Luke Skywalker and wasn't in this arc, and I think it gets back to this sort of underlying wish that I can't shake, that the Disney era Lucasfilm had just done standalones instead of episodes. Because yeah. I think that I go into a Rogue One or a Solo, or, you know, when I sit down for the Game of Thrones guys movies or Rian Johnson's next trilogy, I'm going to sit down saying, this is your story. Have fun. There's a different sort of thing with an episode. And so
yeah, don't have those expectations. I mean, and again, that's the thing. And there's a reason why, because for six films, we have a certain expectation now of what should come. It should fall in line with what we've gotten before. And that doesn't mean it can't be surprising. Or, I mean, you know, George Lucas surprised a lot of people when he had Anakin be a little kid in the first movie, you
right.
know, and then the way it all played out, there were some serious surprises there for people. But it, of course, always feels true because it's Lucas who is doing this tome poem thing and continuing that. And I would say this, I don't think that this is just, I don't think this has much to do as much with Rian Johnson as it does with just the overall creation of the sequel trilogy.
Right.
Because I think what it needed was a massive connection and collaboration with everyone who is going to be involved with the sequel trilogy.
Yes.
Sitting down to figure it out. And then to enact their game plan, because they knew it was going to happen.
Right.
And because this is not the Marvel universe. Again, you can make them feel more Marvel-y movies in the sense of, like, they can be different things when they're not the sequels to the episodes, when they're not episodes. And so, and I can't place, that's not Ryan's fault. He came in and did what they asked him to do, really. And he used all of the freedom that they gave him. So that's, again, that's not his fault either.
Right.
I can't blame Ryan for doing what Ryan wanted to do when they gave him the freedom to do what he wanted to do.
Well, and I think that this is something that, you know, I keep coming back to, that I think really needs to be very clear. I know, you know, everybody knows how charged these discussions have been. And I think that we're saying very clearly, it's possible to have disagreements with what mm-hmm. the director chose to do. And that does not mean I think he is a bad person or doesn't have talent or anything like that. There are tons of movies that I watch where I say, I'm not. And if I watch the making of stuff, like, you know, I remember watching listening to the commentary of Sleepy Hollow, Tim Burton's Sleepy Hollow. And then where he explained a couple of things. And I remember sitting there with my girlfriend at the time and, you know, my face scrunching up and going, oh, yeah, no, that's why that didn't work. You know, like, and it's, you know, it's fine. It is what it is. And, you know, I mean, it doesn't make us people who are clinging on to anything. It's just, you know, he did his movie and we're critiquing it the way we would any movie. And it doesn't take anything away from who he is or mm-hmm. what he's accomplished.
Right.
I mean, he's directed one more Star Wars movie than I ever have. So, you know, like, hey, yeah, he kind of won the lottery on that one. So I can't take that away from him.
Well, there are some other great extras. I know you haven't gotten to listen to the audio commentary just yet, just time-wise, but it is interesting. Some of the stuff you heard and saw in Director and the Jedi kind of gets repeated a little bit, but I think it's definitely a very interesting thing to listen through. There are some places where I wish Ryan had talked more in depth about certain areas I would have really liked to have heard his thoughts on, because I enjoy listening to him talk about what he thought and why he was doing something, because again, he's a very thoughtful person and he does explain things very well. But overall, I really enjoyed that. The scene breakdowns were actually pretty cool too, that they did, lighting the spark, creating the space battle, and Snoke and Mears showdown at Crait. All of those were pretty neat, as they just kind of broke down how they did certain things. So definitely enjoyable to watch. Andy Serkis live was interesting. Did you see that one at all, John?
Yes. He's a tremendous performer.
Amazing.
He's tremendous.
I don't know why Andy Serkis doesn't get more stuff just as an actor.
Oh, I completely agree. I think
he's so good.
Yeah, he's a terrific actor. I think he was criminally underused in the Marvel Universe.
Absolutely.
He was a great. He really brought a character to life that, and you know, as a testament to his skill.
I would say he was criminally underused in Star Wars too, but.
Well, yeah, that's a whole other discussion, isn't it? Yeah. He's an electrifying guy. And you have to give him so much credit, because you can see the other actors responding to him while he has all this junk on his face.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
around
he
his
looks
body.
Ridiculous, right?
Yeah. But he
what
a performer that he can still capture them. I mean, he is at his core, I think, probably just as amazing an actor as Daniel Day-Lewis. Because he inhabits something so...
Yeah, I agree.
But Daniel Day-Lewis has the advantage of dressing and looking like his character. And Andy Serkis, you know, he's either an ape or an 8-foot-tall mystery character. Or, you know, like, it's crazy. He's amazing.
He's an international man of mystery in this. The last one that I'm thinking about that... and I agree with everything you said. It was so much fun to watch his performance. Like, he's just incredible. It's one of the things I loved about watching the extras for The Hobbit when he was doing the scene with Martin Freeman in the cave. Again, it's just one of those places where he's just so phenomenal. as an actor, and the scene just flies off the screen because it, I mean, you're just electrified. So yeah, it's the same thing here. I mean, honestly, too, the throne room scene is the best scene in the film anyway.
Yes.
So I mean, it just hands down is the best scene in the film. The last thing, I don't know if you've gotten a chance to take a look at this at all, but is the score only version of the film.
No, you know, I've been, I watched all the extras. I purposely am watching all the extras to see if it makes any impact on my overall review of Last Jedi. Like, I want to go in with all of the stuff, and I've wrestled with the idea of whether I'm going to rewatch just the straight version or rewatch it as score only first.
Mm-hmm.
I'm back and forth on that. Have you watched the score only?
I have not watched the entire thing score only. I've watched probably a good third or more of it, and it's interesting. Not to be overly critical, but watching it score only accentuates for me personally the weakness of this Star Wars score.
Oh, yeah. No, that's a fair comment, because I was not overly nuts about the score either.
And it surprises me because I do feel like there are moments in the film, even that opening battle, where I would have loved Williams to use more than just the First Order theme and the Resistance theme back and forth kind of thing, like to create a new thing. But then I was thinking about it in my head, too. I was like, well, this movie literally takes place, you know, maybe days at most. So, you know, whereas the original trilogy and the prequel trilogy, there's this time period gap. So each movie has different sounds, but some similar things, too. So I'm wondering if that was part of, you know, Williams' thought process when creating this score, is that the music cannot be overly different because we really haven't had any time pass. And I don't know if that had been part of his thought process when he's writing the score.
Right.
So I don't know. That may be maybe making an excuse, but
maybe the thing then is to listen to or watch a score-only version of The Force Awakens right into a score-only version of The Last Jedi and see if that score
could
make sense on that level. But I honestly, if you're going to give me a score only version of The Last Jedi, there are six other films where actually really like to have that happen.
Oh, can you imagine Episode 3 score only version, especially just the beginning?
Oh, are you? Oh, please. Are you kidding?
I'm breaking my own heart right now.
Episode 3 has my absolute favorite opening
into
transitional cue of the entire saga. Just with I remember it taking my breath away when the camera was panning down and you just heard the drums.
Yep.
It was so amazing.
Bum, bum. Bum,
right.
Bum.
It was like, I was bum, like, what's bum. Going on?
Yes.
This is different. I don't know what's happening.
Man. So I do have one more question before we get out of here, John, because I got to tell you, the rays of Krayt are getting a little steamy and hot.
The salt dries you out.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And the salt's not doing me any favors either, although it is great for margarita glasses. So,
And you would think that the saltines supply would be, you know.
Oh, they're endless. And I tell you what, those Vulpexes, little crystalline foxes, are so great at bringing you more food. I'm just like, hey, beer me, and they, you know. So
now I'm wondering what it would be like to pet those.
Painful.
Did you get splinters?
Ooh,
you have to get splinters.
Crystalline,
right?
Splinters sounds awful.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Okay, so but the last question is this. Watching these extras, did it move the needle either way for you for The Last Jedi?
In terms of how I regard the film overall, no. But it did, I think, blunt some of the criticisms I've been more vocal about. Because once I understand somebody's thinking for things, I can at least say, well, I still disagree with you, but at least I know where you were coming from, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I stand. What about you?
I will be honest. It kind of hurt. I think that the rewatch that I did with the director's commentary by the time I was done, this movie moved from a 3 to a 2.5.
Ouch. So you're saying watch the score only version is what you're telling me.
So, and it wasn't because of anything Johnson was saying. Like, I didn't learn anything new there, but to me the amount of problems with the storytelling, it's too much. It's too much. And I'll be fascinating. I think with this, we'll probably for a while be wrapping up what we say about The Last Jedi, because we got Solo coming out. We've got plenty of other things that we're going to want to do here.
I just want to say really quick, at this point, especially because all of the arguments have struck up again with Last Jedi, I think I'm on some level looking forward to Solo just so we all have something different to talk about.
Absolutely.
Let us move on, please.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm definitely looking forward to it. You know, Ron Howard has made it look so much fun with the pictures he's been tweeting and stuff. So yeah, I'm definitely ready. Look, if you're listening to this and you love The Last Jedi, and I appreciate you listening, I don't hate Rian Johnson. I don't hate the movie, because there are some amazing things in it. And I am still very interested to see where they take the story next. And honestly, I think that it's going to have to be wowing, because I don't know where you go next. I really don't know exactly what you do next after this ending. So I'm intrigued, you know, color me intrigued. So, John, if anybody wants to talk to you about, the extras here or anything else that you're thinking about Star Wars, where can they find you there on the old interwebs?
Nobody ever wants to talk to me about these things. I don't know why. You can find me here on the network co-hosting Great Shot Kid with Mike Schindler. And you can find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig. Matt, if people want to either harass or applaud you for your views here, where can they reach you?
Well, I mean, gosh, that's what the internet's for. I'm on Twitter at MattRushing02. I'm on Instagram under the same name. I'm also here on the network doing another show with Dre Kaufman as we talk all about Harry Potter one chapter at a time on Owl Post. So that's a lot of fun. I'm on the Trek FM network talking with Chris Jones all about Star Trek Deep Space Nine and the Orb. And then I do the General Geek Show over there, the 602 Club, which is just a blast. In fact, I was just planning the Solo show there, which John should be on because
you never know. I might be hiding on an island somewhere.
Yeah. Anyway, and then I'm doing Cinema Stories with my friend Courtney, talking about film through the lens of faith. But I got to say, John, I think there's only one thing left to say. And it's time to close negotiations.
Matt, negotiations are closed.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.